Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In 1970, Congress placed marijuana in Schedule I of the Controlled Substances Act because, among other reasons, it was believed to have no accepted medical use. Well, attitudes have changed since then. A nationwide Harris poll finds 83% of us now in favor of legalizing marijuana for medical purposes. 33 states and D.C., including Ohio and West Virginia, have legalized medical marijuana. Legislation that would legalize medical marijuana in Kentucky failed to pass in the 2019 General Assembly, but will likely be taken up again in the 2020 session. A proposal to legalize recreational marijuana also is planned. Many of us are looking for something non-addicting that relieves chronic pain but with no psychoactive effects that can cloud the clarity and the logic we need for our work or to meet life's obligations and responsibilities. What does science tell us? Dr. Shana Babilonis researches marijuana in the Department of Behavioral Science at the University of Kentucky College of Medicine, and she presented findings before a standing room only crowd at a recent forum hosted by the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky. I was there, and after listening, invited Dr. Babilonis to highlight her research for you. Greetings, Shana.
Thank you.
So we can get something out of the way in the very beginning. Tell us about the sources of the funding that supported your research.
So I receive all of my research funding from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is a division of the National Institutes of Health. So it's all government funded, and my research is not industry sponsored, so I'm not influenced by any corporations or medical marijuana companies.
Lots of states, as I mentioned, have legalized medical marijuana, and Kentucky could be one of the next to join them. Do we know enough to make an informed decision?
I think that's a bit of a tricky question. So the state of marijuana science right now doesn't really show us a clear path for any given indication. The data on pain aren't that convincing right now. And most people want medical marijuana for the treatment of pain. Whenever you look at that in randomized controlled, placebo-controlled trials, the data really just aren't there to suggest that it's a very effective pain reliever.
So getting people off of opioids was part of the argument behind legalization in Ohio and West Virginia, which have severe problems with opioids, just as Kentucky does. And your research has focused on both opioids and marijuana. So I'm wondering, in your opinion, is cannabis a potential substitute for opioids as pain relief medicine?
The data that we have right now would point to no, that medical marijuana is not an effective replacement for opioids in terms of pain relief or for opioid use disorder or so folks who are addicted to opioids.
Do we know anything about the interactions of opioids and cannabinoids in humans?
That's a really good question. So that is the focus of my research. So right now I have a grant funded from the National Institute on Drug Abuse to really dig into that question. We bring folks into the laboratory and we give them doses of vaporized marijuana. We give them doses of opioids and are really trying to figure out that interaction question. And so what does it really mean for risk factors for opioid overdose? So one of my primary outcome measures is looking at respiratory depression. We know that when folks take opioids, the biggest risk is decreasing their breathing, and that's what contributes to overdose deaths. And so my research is primarily focusing right now on, does marijuana protect against that? Does it help people continue to breathe, or does it make that respiratory depression worse?
So are you more or less looking into the possibility that marijuana could supplement opioid medication?
I've looked at that question specifically. I've done a study that enrolled healthy participants, and we exposed them to different painful sensations. So we asked them to put their arm in cold water and tell us how much it hurt and to pull their arm out when they can no longer tolerate that pain. We applied pressure to their hands, different sensory modalities to try to figure out what different drugs do in those models. Isolated THC did not help those pain outcomes. Oxycodone did help those. When you put the two together, THC and oxycodone, THC did not give oxycodone any boost. So it really looked like it didn't help oxycodone do its job. And in some cases, it blocked oxycodone's effects.
In your studies, did you find that cannabis can reduce the opioid dosage needed for pain relief? It sounds as though it really didn't make any difference.
It did not make any difference. We couldn't decrease the opioid dose and still get analgesia.
Can it decrease opioid side effects?
That's a really good question. So in that same study, we found that THC did not enhance oxycodone's pain-relieving effects. However, it really drastically increased the participants' ratings of feeling high and impaired and liking the drug effects. So it was kind of the worst possible scenario you can imagine for an analgesic drug. So it doesn't help relieve any pain, but it increases the side effects, particularly impairment and feeling high.
And I'm just guessing here, but am I right that THC is the component of marijuana that would apply here?
That's right. That's right.
And of course, THC is psychoactive.
It is psychoactive.
So it's not going to stand as that non-psychoactive alternative that I mentioned a few minutes ago.
No. And so we even looked at pretty low doses that you wouldn't anticipate would cause any side effects. So that was really the point of that research. Can we find low doses of THC that would help opioid effects so you could decrease opioid doses and then also not contribute to drug high and impairment? And so we tried to actually answer that question specifically, and we found that no, even really low doses do contribute to the high when combined with opioids.
In August, Surgeon General Jerome Adams warned that while the perceived harm of marijuana is decreasing what we think about marijuana, the scary truth, as he put it, is that, quote, the actual potential for harm is increasing. And continuing with his quote, this ain't your mother's marijuana. What can you tell us about concentrations of THC, the property of marijuana that produces the high, as we've talked about? What can you tell us about those concentrations in today's strains of marijuana?
First, I'd just like to take a step back and just remind everyone that THC itself, medical marijuana, is not going to cause anyone to overdose and die. I think that's a really important thing to clarify. Mm-hmm. As we talk about marijuana risks, marijuana is harmful when animals, pets, and children ingest it. That can cause toxic side effects. But in otherwise normal, healthy people, it won't cause an overdose. And then just to answer your question about concentration, the concentrations have increased over 200-fold from the 70s in medical marijuana and marijuana in general. So, for example, in the 1970s, if you looked at the concentrations of THC in all of the confiscated marijuana in the United States, it was around 1 to 2% THC. In the 1980s and 1990s, it increased to about 3 or 4%. In the early 2000s, roughly 10%. And right now, in the United States, it's about 19% on average. If you go into a dispensary for either medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, you'll frequently find that most of the products are about 20% THC.
Wow. So as the Surgeon General says,
it's not your granddaddy's marijuana now.
Right. And marijuana, as I mentioned in the introduction, is a Schedule I drug.
That's right.
So what does that mean, and how has that affected your ability to even conduct research on it?
So what Schedule I refers to, it's a classification by the DEA. And what it means is that there is no medical utility. It has a very high propensity for abuse. And there's no data or data that's lacking on its safety.
And so you're trying to research it. You need to get your hands on
marijuana through legal channels. There's a lot at stake in the way you go about that, adhering to the requirements of your grant and so forth. Does the fact that it's Schedule I make it difficult for you to obtain the material that you need to work with?
Absolutely. So any researcher that studies marijuana, particularly in humans, has to go through a lot of different channels to be able to do that kind of work. There are regulatory procedures through the DEA. You have to obtain a Schedule I drug license. And Schedule I drugs are marijuana, but they also include LSD, MDMA or ecstasy. And so marijuana is in that classification that it's illegal for everyone. Even though we know it's legal in different states for different reasons, it's federally a Schedule I drug. So we have to work through the DEA. And then we also have to work with the FDA to be able to show that it's safe to put into humans the way that we're going to do it. And a really important point of clarification here is that we have to work through the University of Mississippi to get all of our plant materials, all of our plant marijuana that we're going to administer to our participants. And so what we can't do, federal researchers and researchers across the United States, they cannot test the plant material that's in the dispensaries, or we can't test the CBD that you buy in the grocery store. We have to get all of our products through sanctioned distributors, which are filtered through the government.
So that means the science is not really telling us much about what is actually out there.
That's right. So if, for example, if we're going to test a CBD product, it has to be produced by a pharmaceutical company and have gone through the rigors of safety, sterility, product testing to be able to test it to be sure that it's safe. So I can't test the CBD that you would buy in Walgreens or from the local dispensaries. And then similarly, the medical marijuana that is available to the different states and in the dispensaries and the recreational marijuana that's in the dispensaries, we can't test that. We have to go through the University of Mississippi and the National Institute on Drug Abuse and test their products.
Well, with so many states, as I mentioned, 33 states, the District of Columbia have now legalized medical marijuana. There is a chance that Kentucky may do so soon and perhaps other states. Do you think, as a researcher who has looked into this in such depth, that marijuana needs to be removed from Schedule I and made more readily available?
I think that question may be a little bit above my pay grade.
But would it make it how can I put this? You, as a researcher, need to be able to study strains that the population interacts with, correct?
That's right. So I can study a limited set of those kinds of strains in what we call cultivars. For my current research, I have available to me different concentrations of smoked marijuana that includes different concentrations of THC and different concentrations of CBD. So I can answer the basic questions with the plant material that's available to me. Now to get more sophisticated and to ask, you know, very relevant questions about the safety of the plant material that's in the dispensaries, no, you can't do that.
Okay, and I want to get to CBDs in just a moment. Before we do that, I want to bounce back to opioids. In your presentation to the recent forum that I attended, you noted that recent studies are showing an opposite effect, increasing opioid overdose deaths in states that have legalized medical marijuana. Why is that happening?
That's a really good question. So I would say about 5 years ago, there was a study published that suggested that states that legalized medical marijuana had a decrease in opioid overdose death rates by about 25%. And that got a lot of the media attention. It got a lot of attention from politicians. And what people took from that is that medical marijuana prevents opioid overdose deaths, which, if true, that would be really amazing. Unfortunately, those were just correlational studies. And so one thing is associated with another without there being any causal information there. So it's not saying medical marijuana caused less deaths. It's just associated with it. New research that's coming out suggests the opposite effect, that states with medical marijuana laws see higher overdose death rates. And again, I don't know if that we can actually trust either. Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty poor way to really look at that question because it is just a correlation and many things can play into that. But the crucial question that we really need to look at is, on an individual level, are the people who are taking medical marijuana, are they less prone to opioid overdose? And that we have zero information on, actually.
So it really sounds to me, to kind of conclude the opioid part of this conversation, that we're just not there yet.
We're not there yet. And so the research that I'm doing right now, as we talked about before, I think can start to chip away at this question. And so my research is really focused on that question specifically. Can marijuana protect people against opioid overdose? And then if you pre-treat people with medical marijuana, will they want opioids less? That's really the question that we're asking, particularly from a drug abuse standpoint. Will medical marijuana protect them against opioid use and misuse?
And the science is still out on that.
The science is still out.
My conversation with Dr. Babylonis continues in a moment when we turn to what we know and what we do not know about CBD dosages and the 21st century version of the canary in the coal mine, honeybees.
Researchers have started to use them as biomarkers. What they bring in from the environment into the hive can show you what kind of pesticides or problems may be in an environment. So in that aspect, they are like canaries in a coal mine.
That's Mary Sheldon. While at EKU pursuing a master's in public health, her in-depth chemical analyses of locally sourced honey identified the presence of heavy metals and pesticides in the majority of samples. Her work made the cover of the peer-reviewed Journal of Environmental Health. It's work that she hopes to continue. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Let's get back to my conversation with Dr. Shana Babylonis. She researches cannabis in the Department of Behavioral Science at the University of Kentucky College of Medicine. Okay, let's jump over to marijuana's close cousin, hemp, and CBD. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere you look now. People are using it for all kinds of purposes, from relieving the pain of aching joints, for example, to enhancing sleep. But does anybody have any idea about appropriate dosages?
Not for the conditions that you mentioned. So the only data that we have for dosages of CBD that are effective are for severe intractable pediatric seizure disorders. So the FDA approved a product called Epidiolex, which is all natural, pure CBD, for the treatment of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome and Dravet syndrome, to childhood onset seizure disorders. We know the dosages that are appropriate for those conditions. Outside of those conditions, we know little to nothing about the appropriate doses of CBD.
And so, again, we can really have no informed idea whether the formulations that we're buying are actually safe and effective.
That's right. So colleagues of mine did a study where they bought different CBD products online and in dispensaries. And they analyze those products for their cannabinoid content. So how much CBD was in them and was there anything else in them? And they found that roughly 70% were mislabeled, meaning that some were had more CBD in them than what was on the label. Others had less. And then they found roughly 25% of the samples that they tested had THC in them, more than what you would expect from the labeling. So typically we see labels of CBD saying trace amounts of THC.
Right.
These had more than just trace levels. So several milligrams per milliliter, several milligrams per serving.
What we typically see on those labels, I've seen numerous different brands that typically say it contains 0.3% THC. But as I understand it, that's really referring to the plant, what's in the bottle, right?
That's right. So that's the plant itself has to be less than 0.3% THC dry weight. That speaks nothing to the oil then that is then derived from that plant and packaged into either a tincture, oils, or pills.
There have been a lot of studies out there, primarily among health professionals, doctors, nurses, that indicate that there is this educational gap related to medical cannabis, that health professionals need to know more because more and more patients are coming to them with all kinds of questions about cannabis and about therapeutic uses. And the University of Maryland has become the first in the country to offer a Master of Science in Medical Cannabis Science and Therapeutics. Response was overwhelming. More than 500 people applied for a class that was supposed to top out at 50. And so I'm just wondering, do you think that other universities across the country, including here in Kentucky, ought to consider this?
Absolutely. The amount of information that we have for cannabinoid science in humans is somewhat limited. And that's due to the regulations that we talked about, it being a Schedule I drug. But what we do have are some studies for some conditions. And I think the more that people know about those studies and their limitations opens up the ability for people to understand the gaps. And then hopefully we'll push research forward within those gaps. But there's not a lot of data yet to even present in those classes.
The 2020 session of the Kentucky General Assembly is coming up. My understanding is that Representative Jason Nemes, a Republican, who introduced the prior legislation that passed out of the Judiciary Committee in the 2019 session, is re-proposing the bill in this coming session. So there probably will be hearings or will be discussion about it. Have you been invited to present your findings in Frankfurt?
Not formally, no. So a few people have talked to me after certain talks that I've given and have asked me about my willingness to testify and present findings. And I've always let everyone know that certainly I would be willing, but haven't ever been formally invited.
Okay, that's a giant hint to Frankfurt. And so, Dr. Babylonis, tell us a little bit more about what you're studying now.
So right now I have a few grants to look at smoked marijuana, vaporized marijuana in the laboratory. One of my studies looks at different strains or concentrations of THC and CBD in healthy participants to look at how it impacts driving performance. And so we have a driving simulator in our laboratory, and we give people different doses of different strains of medical marijuana, and we try to figure out how it might impact their driving, and we're comparing that to standardized doses of alcohol.
And do those strains contain the levels of THC that you were talking about just a few minutes ago, the higher, much higher levels?
Yes, they do. I was really lucky to get some high-potency marijuana from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So, yes, they do.
Okay. Well, can we invite you back when you have results from those studies? We'd like to hear about them.
Absolutely.
Dr. Shana Babylonis is an assistant professor in the Department of Behavioral Science at the University of Kentucky of Medicine. We thank you so much, Shana.
Thank you.
And if you're interested in this issue and want to know more about the arguments for and against medical marijuana, we recommend the online resource Pro-Con, one word, procon.org. There is nothing like a steaming hot cup of tea on a cold winter evening to warm the soul. I like mine with a dollop of local honey. So a recent article in the Richmond Register really grabbed my attention. It was about in-depth chemical analyses on locally sourced honey that identified the presence of heavy metals and pesticides in the majority of samples. It was the work of Mary Sheldon as she pursued a master's in public health from Eastern Kentucky University. And clearly, I was hardly alone in noticing. Mary's research so impressed the editors of the Journal of Environmental Health that they made it the cover story of the July-August issue of the peer-reviewed journal. Mary Sheldon is here with us. Greetings, Mary.
Hello.
Why did you choose honey as the focus of your research on environmental contamination?
It is a consumable that a lot of people are starting to increase. The uptake of it because of its natural healthy benefits to it. So in regards to public health, we wanted to check and make sure that everything, you know, was copacetic with the honey being produced out there.
What steered you in the direction of, or who steered you in the direction of researching honey?
When I was getting my sociology degree, I had a professor who was a wonderful mentor for me. It was Dr. Stephanie McSpirit. And she gave us an assignment. This was for environmental sociology. And we were to find an environmental issue to write on. I had read an article on bees. Had no idea that they were as important agriculturally for our nutrition, that every third bite that we eat is directly related to bees, that kind of thing. So all of this was very new to me, and it was very exciting to learn about it. So that kind of steered me learning about what was happening with bees at the time, which was colony collapse disorder, how it was affecting agriculture, how it was affecting nutrition, and how societies react to their environment. It kind of got started along those lines, and then it went into public health with the way people were reacting with their environment.
So I take it to kind of fast forward that you gathered then a collection of samplings of locally sourced honey.
I did. There were 12 different counties in Kentucky. It was a small sampling, but we got a grant from EKU. To do this research. And we did get a hold of 12 different counties where we got the honey from to do the sampling. And we would have liked to have had more, but the sampling that we did was pretty much spread out across Kentucky. So that gave us a good idea what was going on in the state.
How do you find these different properties in a sample?
We sent it to the USDA labs to do the sampling for us. What we were originally looking for, because of the Zika virus that was going on, there was a great deal of mosquito spraying. I think it had risen over 50% for homeowners. We were wanting to see if that was affecting, if the bees were bringing it back into the hives. Was it affecting honey? Was it going to affect consumers? What we found out through the USDA labs was the pesticide that they were using was a pyrethroid insecticide, and it did evidently dissipate fast enough that it wasn't showing up in our honey samples. But when Dr. Pena met Dr. Zamari at a meeting, she wanted to test it for organochlorine pesticides and heavy metals, and that's when we started seeing stuff show up.
And the Dr. Zamari that you refer to co-authored the report that ended up being published.
Yes, and she is from the University of Georgia.
So you were looking for these pesticides, but you found other things. What did you find?
Statistically significant was the DDT levels that we found in 72% actually of the samples that we had, we found levels of DDT. And 55% of them, we found levels of lead that were a little bit disturbing. We did find other pesticides, but those two were statistically significant.
And to underscore the significance of finding DDT, it was banned decades ago.
In 1972.
And I think I recall then being told that it was going to persist in the environment for a long time. Here we are, 2019, and there it is.
Yes, it's still out there, and at levels that are a little bit concerning.
Do you regard the honey as something of a canary in a coal mine, or the bee itself?
Bees actually have that. Researchers have started to use them as biomarkers. What they bring in from the environment into the hive can show you what kind of pesticides or problems may be in an environment. So in that aspect, they are like canaries in a coal mine. That will show up in their products readily because they're bringing it in. It's more... Organochlorine pesticides tend to bond itself more to like a waxy substance. So that tends to be more in the comb, but other things will show up in a water base like the honey.
A slight little bit off topic. We'll come back to it in just a minute, but I think our listeners would also be interested to hear about your career track, which is pretty interesting. You earned your degree after something like 3 decades in the workforce as a dental ceramist, correct?
I have, and I'm still working as a dental ceramist.
What inspired you to go back to school?
I think at the time, my son was grown. My husband's a school, elementary school teacher. And it just felt like I wanted to find out what was going on out there. When you've been in a career over 30 years and you get so narrowly focused on that career, you forget a lot of what's happening in other areas. And some of the things I had just been reading made me want to go back and develop my education. I have been in the dental business for so long that I just wanted something different.
Was it hard to go back to college?
It wasn't. I mean, I've always loved education. Going to EKU, I think, made it easier because it's a smaller campus. And I have to admit that Dr. Stephanie McSpirit made it exceptionally easy. It was almost like she took me under her wing and introduced me to people, took me to... different meetings, anything that I thought I might be interested in, she was right there trying to help me out with it. So that made it a lot easier to go back after that many years.
So back to your honey research and the success that you've had in publicizing it, what do you plan to do now with what you've learned?
I have talked to Dr. Pinion and corresponded a little with Dr. Zamiri, and she's still on board. If we could find the grant money, what we would like to do is expand the research, just because the sampling size was smaller than we would have liked, just to keep an eye on what's going on out there in the environment. If we can help beekeepers, because bees are under an enormous amount of stress. Working with Tammy Potter, the state apiarist, she does wonderful things to promote bees and beekeeping, and I have worked with her on several projects. I think if we could expand our research or my research into showing what's out there in the environment, maybe then we could teach people to reduce their dependency on pesticides or anything that would help bring back some insect life.
What would you say to those of us who really enjoy our local honey? Some of us even have bought into the idea that maybe it counters allergies from time to time. Seems to work for me. But in any case, I like local honey. What would you tell me about your findings? Should I just cut it out altogether or just use honey in moderation?
The amount of honey that you're going to be using in a cup of tea or whatever, you're not going to really develop anything from that, I wouldn't think. Would I suggest that people use local honey if they're going to be using it? Absolutely. There is some enormous benefits to using honey, which I think would override any concern over some pesticides that may be present.
A link to Mary Sheldon's report, Pesticide Contamination in Central Kentucky Urban Honey, a Pilot Study, is posted on our website. That's esweku.com. You'll find it there under the Facts and Information tab. Thanks for coming in, Mary.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sweeter than a honeybee, yeah, baby, been sweet on me. Sweeter than a honeybee, yeah, my queen bee. Oh, she rocked me to my soul. Ooh, rocked me to my soul. Oh, she rocked me to my soul. Ooh, she rocked me to my soul.
Coming up in a moment, Elizabeth Engelhart, co-author of The Food We Eat, The Stories We Tell, a book about contemporary Appalachian kitchens and the stories they hold. We'll be joined by a contributor to the book, West Virginia folklorist Emily Hilliard. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The Food We Eat, The Stories We Tell is a book about contemporary Appalachian kitchens and tables and the stories they hold. We're joined by Elizabeth Engelhart, professor of Southern Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Elizabeth co-authored the book with Laura Smith, a founding member of the Appalachian Food Summit and director of Eastern Standard Production co-sponsor, the Appalachian Impact Fund. Also here with us is Emily Hilliard, West Virginia State folklorist, founding director of the West Virginia Folklife Program, and among the 20 writers from around the region who contributed works to the book. And we welcome you, Elizabeth and Emily.
Thanks for having us.
And Elizabeth, first, simple question, what's the book about?
The book might surprise you a little bit. It's not a cookbook. It's not a collection of food history where we try to find the very first. But what it is a collection of people who are talking about why food matters to them in Appalachia. And it's a wide range of people so that we get a picture of food today and the stories that we tell about it.
So this connects food with narrative.
It does. It leads with those stories, because if you tell me why a food matters to you, if you tell me your history with that food, your family's relationship to it, your moment of discovery with it, and I tell you my story, then we're starting to understand about who we are, where we came from, where we're headed, what might draw us together.
Commenting on the book, writer Silas House says, "Nothing else besides food nourishes us as profoundly as stories." How does a focus on the foods of Appalachia open doors to better understanding such a complex culture?
I'm glad you said complex. That's what we had in mind with this project. Appalachia is a place where the stereotypes or what people think they understand about it can really flatten the amazing diversity, the diversity of foods, the diversity of flavors, but most importantly, the diversity of people. Who's here? Who's been here? How are they interacting with each other? There's a great article in the book that's about Blue Ridge Tacos and Blue Ridge Taquerias, and it's looking at places where there are food festivals, where there are rodeos, where there are tacos being eaten, where there are local beers being drunk, where all of those things come together and people are starting to learn about each other.
Emily, your contribution to the book is titled The Reason We Make These Deep Fat Fried Treats, in conversation with the Rosettes of Helvetia, West Virginia. What's this about?
So Helvetia, population 59, is a mountain town in Randolph County, West Virginia, that was settled by Swiss immigrants in 1869. And at their centennial in 1969, it was far enough away from the World Wars that they felt comfortable celebrating their Swiss-German heritage again. And there was a town matriarch, Eleanor Mayu, who revived many of these Swiss traditions, one of them being their food traditions. So she started this Hütte restaurant that still is open every day and serves a variety of Swiss traditional foods. And she also brought back their Fastnacht tradition, which is their version of Mardi Gras. And like a good Mardi Gras celebration, it involves fried pastries. So rosettes are one of those fried pastries that some of the Farm Women's Club members make for this pre-Lenten feast every year. So rosettes are a crispy kind of cookie fried in oil.
You describe the utensil that's used to do that as looking kind of like a branding iron, and it's dipped into the dough and then dipped into the hot oil.
That's right. That's right. And so in the research for the piece, I found that there actually is a connection with these branding irons and rosette irons. I found that many cultures all over the world have a type of rosette tradition. And in Turkey, they also had kind of a coat of arms, particular pattern for each family. So each family had their own cookie shape made with these rosette irons.
Oh, that's a very tasty idea.
Yeah.
and so Helvetia was one of several Swiss settlements in West Virginia.
Right.
What makes it stand out?
Well, Helvetia is special because they had these town matriarchs like Eleanor Mayu who were invested in reviving these traditions. She had been living abroad in Guam and returned back and said, you know, this thing that we have, our Swiss identity, our Swiss culture, our foodways, our traditions, our festivals, these are important and we should celebrate them. So she worked very diligently with some of the other women in the community to bring back these traditions. And you can really see today the impact that has had in the identity of the community. It's very cohesive. These families have been living together for generations, their colleagues, their family, their friends. So it does have this really strong sense of place that not all communities have in West Virginia.
And I read in your piece that Helvetia is home to a ramp supper. And folks from outside the region might not know what that is. So first, could you tell us what a ramp is and then the ways that it's celebrated?
Sure. So ramps are a wild leek that are one of the first greens that appear in the mountains in the spring. So traditionally, it was eaten as sort of a spring tonic, a celebration of the return to green things. And now ramps are celebrated in the region with ramp suppers. And, you know, a lot of things in Helvetia are both for the identity of the town and to bring tourists to this tiny place in the mountains. So the ramp supper kind of serves that dual purpose. It's put on by the Farm Women's Club, and they bake all the desserts. And the weeks preceding the ramp supper, children in the community volunteer and help wash ramps because, you know, being a sort of green that grows in the ground, they need to be washed kind of intensely because there's a lot of mud that collects on the roots and the stem. So kids help wash them. Other members of the community, I watched a group of men fry or boil potatoes over an open fire outside. They serve ham. There's often sassafras tea, some kind of cornbread. And so it's kind of a community fundraiser, both for tourists and for people just kind of coming out of their houses at the end of winter, celebrating the return to spring.
I've heard ramp described as sort of garlic meets onion.
Right, right.
And it has a very distinctive fragrance.
Yes, it's strong smelling. One of the girls that I interviewed said, you know, she would come down for weeks and weeks scrubbing these ramps and go to school and just reek of ramps. she was complaining about that, but she also had a real hand in reviving this ramp supper. And I like to talk about her, Morgan Rice, because she is a young person who understands the importance of these traditions to her community and really helped revive this tradition that was going away.
And, you know, ramps appear in a second article in the book by Erica Locklear, where she is talking about her grandmother's aging process. And one of the points that Erica makes is that she grew up eating ramps. One of the problems with ramps being picked up by chefs around the country, you can find it on menus in New York City, you can find them sold at some Whole Foods around the country, is that ramps are incredibly hard to domesticate. So that is still a wild food. And if we overharvest them, then we lose that ability for people to feed themselves off of something that they've had access to for a long time. And so Erica, in her piece, is also talking about her grandmother shifting away from that time-intensive and difficult food to prepare with the ramps, and those are becoming less and less accessible to her. And she ends up starting to use banquet frozen fried chicken to make the meal that comes at the end of the tobacco harvest, which her family still does a little bit of growing of tobacco in Western North Carolina. But part of her point, and I think, Emily, part of your point in your piece, one of the things I really like about it is that we can keep the family meanings, we can keep those stories. We might have to shift the way we tell them. So telling it through a frozen fried chicken dinner, telling it through a slightly modified recipe for the rosettes, right, still we can keep the stories and we can figure out how to keep the meaning of the communities in those stories.
I think both of you have just demonstrated, literally demonstrated, that connection between food and narrative, how food is almost a metaphor for the culture. And I want to recommend that everybody go to Google and type in Helvetia, West Virginia. That's H-E-L-V-E-T-I-A, West Virginia. And you'll bring up Emily's article for The Bitter Southerner, 1 year in Helvetia, West Virginia. Lots of images, a video there. And in that article, there's a quote about tradition. And I'd like to ask you both about this. It says, a tradition is a by-mouth thing, and you do what you can do with what you've got. You do what you can do with the ingredients you have. So tradition can actually be a little flexible, a little fluid, according to circumstance, correct?
Right. And so as a folklorist, I think about tradition being both static. You know, there are elements that need to stay the same in order for it to continue as a tradition, but also tradition must be dynamic, so it must change and evolve over context and time in order to stay relevant, in order to stay alive. And so one of the things I'm writing about in the piece on rosettes is the way that these women who are making them are negotiating the steps along the way. So there's a moment when they kind of question, should we use powdered sugar or should we use granulated sugar? And they say, well, we use what we've got. Up here, we're far away from a grocery store. Maybe we'll try powdered sugar this year. If we don't like it, we'll try granulated again next year. They also are using different fats to fry them in. So Eleanor Bettler, when she had an active farm, had lard on hand to fry the rosettes in. Now that she doesn't, lard is expensive, she switched to vegetable oil and says, you know, it's a little healthier. It's still deep fat fried, so it's not the most healthy thing. But tradition is just evolving, and it's changing according to, you know, need and necessity, what people have on hand. It mutates as it goes through time.
The Appalachian region in particular, the central Appalachian region in these times, is in search of a new path for its economy. And there are lots of ideas out there. Is the local food movement a part of that picture?
It absolutely is. I think one of the strong and important features of working with food is that you can start up a business with a relatively small amount of capital. You can think about what it is that you know how to do well and deeply, and that become the basis for your food business. And whether that's growing food or distributing it or creating restaurant pop-up meals, things like that. I'm actually working on a different book right now. My next book will be about boarding houses in the South. And one of the things that strikes me about boarding houses, and this is true of the ones in Central Appalachia, is that those were often places that people started out of nothing. And I think there's something important in that. Now, I think if we do that, then we also need to pay some attention about how that's going to be sustainable, how we really take care of each other's labor, how we're valuing the knowledge that people have and dealing with them in respectful ways. And all those questions are part of the food movement right now, and it's good that they're part of the food movement.
When I hear you say that, I think the phrase, oh, the stories these walls could tell, that's going to be really interesting. In an afterword in the book, James Beard, award-winning author Ronnie Lundy, who's a big proponent of the local food movement, says, quoting her, "Sitting at the Appalachian table, we can taste the proof of a strong, lasting, surprisingly diverse, and infinitely textured history. Is it that complexity of the culture that all too often has been portrayed as monolithic that you're getting at in this book?"
It absolutely is. I come from Western North Carolina, so I come from a part of Appalachia that is has been agriculture-based, has been racially and ethnically diverse for a long time. That is the land of Cherokee people, that has a very complex and layered story of people living on those lands and eating on those lands and sharing food there. And that's one of the things we wanted to do with this book, is just really think about who's at the Appalachian table.
Where can the food we eat, the stories we tell, be found?
Well, you can find it online at Ohio University Press, their website, also your local bookstore. And if they don't have it, I'm sure they will order it for you.
Elizabeth Engelhart, co-author with Laura Smith of The Food We Eat, The Stories We Tell, and a contributor to the book, Emily Hilliard. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Last week's show featured an interview with Derek Ramsey in his role as Kentucky Secretary of Education and Workforce Development. We've since learned that with the change of administrations from Bevin to Beshear, Mr. Ramsey will be succeeded in the role of Secretary by Jacqueline Coleman, who was recently elected Lieutenant Governor. She will fill both positions. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.